This episode is brought to you by the GoDaddy coupon CJC's Sigler C, which snags you a brand new .com domain for just 99 cents. Don't want a .com? Hell, player! You can get .net, .org, and other goodies as well. Christmas is coming. What better way to tell your kids, hey, I have faith in your idea, than to get a .com of their name or their prospective business? Are they going to be consultants, artists, photographers, musicians, designers, etc.? Then get them the .com for their name or other business name before some Grinch does it first and spoils Christmas future for everyone. That's the GoDaddy code CJC Sigler C. Write it down and learn more at scottsigler.com/GoDaddy. And now, on with our story.
Welcome to the serial audiobook Alone, an unabridged podcast of Book 3 of the Generations trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. This novel is available in print as an ebook or as a full-length unabridged audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Audible, please visit scottsigler.com/alone.
Hello, junkies. Happy holidays. Here we are at episode number 10 of Alone. Double digits. It's huge. It's prodigious. It's enormous. It's splendid. I don't know why I celebrate this on every podcast novel, the 10th episode, but we are creatures of base 10. And for some reason, 10s resonate in our culture. I am out of the office right now because I had a gig last night with my rock band. So sound quality may be a wee bit down. We'll be back on track in the sound booth next week. We had a crazy week of LA meetings last week, some more TV opportunities. I will tell you about that after the podcast, what I can tell you anyways. I'm also very much getting back into playing music, and I will tell you about that after the podcast as well. So for now, let me get you caught up on the story, and then we're going to put that star on top of that tree. Aw, yeah. Previously on Alone. With the basilisk destroyed, the birthday children are preparing for the next orbital threat, the goblin. But the dangers aren't all external. Em and her friends are trying to cope with their increased unexplained aggression. How long will it be before it isn't the enemy they are fighting, but instead each other? Find out next on Alone, episode number 10.
Part 2. Signals and Silence. 20. I circle left, Bawden circles right. Our boots press into the fine white sand of our training circle. We point practice wooden spears at each other.
This isn't a dance class,
Bishop calls out. He wants us to strike. I've sparred with Bawden enough to know she's blindingly fast with a block and counterattack. I'm trying to figure out her footwork, wait for the right moment to strike. All around us, I hear the clack-clack of spears and farm tools bouncing off each other or thudding into bodies. After we destroyed the basilisk, the goblin slowed its approach, stopped, then moved a little farther away from Omayokan. We've shown what we can do, and the ship reacted accordingly. Still, we've prepared hard. Our weapons are cleaned, loaded, or charged. We've set up primary plans for responding to any landing craft. Barca and Lafa have returned to Shetchak. In short, we are as ready as we can be. If we're attacked, we don't know when we might be outside again. Bishop insisted on one last training session here on the plaza, so we might enjoy the sunshine while we still can. I agreed, but not for his reasons. I've been so busy running here and there, answering endless questions, pushing Juan to keep exploring the shaft, and seeing to 1,000 other things that can't happen at all without my input. I'm frustrated. I want the release that hard training brings. I want to forget, just for a few moments, the endless pressure we're all under. In other words, I want to hit something. Bawden finally thrusts. I parry, blocking her attack. She grins.
Come at me, little empty, she says. Prove you're a real warrior.
taunts won't work, sweetheart, I answer as I circle. Your mouth says such mean things, but your eyes tell me how much you love me. Bawden laughs. When she does, I snap out a knee strike. She barely blocks it. Hardness settles into her eyes. Farrar, our other trainer for the day, shouts at us.
Didn't Bishop tell you you're not dancing? Finish your foe now!
I think I have her timing. I thrust at her face. She ducks and spins. I've fought her before. No, she'll sweep my legs as she completes that spin, so I jump before she does. Her spear's wooden blade whizzes harmlessly beneath my feet. I land and lunge in the same motion before she can bring her spear up to defend, put my blade behind her feet, and throw my shoulder into her chest. Bawden falls hard on her back, air whoofing out of her lungs. My wooden spear tip is at her throat. She freezes.
Point savage,
Farrar says.
Way to be predictable, Bawden.
She glares up at him.
I want 2 out of 3!
Which will look nice on your gravestone.
Bawden slaps the sand in frustration. I guess it's not as fun when she loses. I offer my hand. She takes it, and I pull her to her feet.
Rotate partners,
Bishop calls out. There are 6 sand-filled circles at the plaza's edge. This is where we train. We practice form movements with spears, blunt knives, rifles with dull bayonets, and whatever random things Farrar brings. Sticks, broken bits of masonry, even rocks. Once, he made us fight with belts. Belts hurt. The main thing we do, though, is spar. 1-on-1, 2-on-1, on our feet, on our backs, one arm tied down as if we were wounded, you name it. These are skills that will keep us alive in combat.
Lucky,
Bawden says.
I'll kick your ass next time, Savage.
Looking forward to it. With that, we both move to the circles on our respective rights. I find myself facing Victor Mueller. Inside, I cringe. I've never beaten him. He shaved his head. The medical coffins healed his scalp burns, but he was left with a big missing patch of hair, so he cut it all off. His locks were beautiful, yet somehow he looks even better with nothing but stubble. Victor smiles at me, wide and genuine, and a little awkward, and I'm suddenly reminded that Bishop thinks this boy has a crush on me.
Bow and begin,
Bishop calls to everyone. Victor and I bow. I grip my spear, hunting for a weakness in the boy's stance. There isn't one. He lunges and thrusts. I parry. His spear whirls so fast, I don't even see his second strike. The wooden blade presses into the side of my neck.
Point, he says. Your hair looks nice today, Em.
My hair's in a tightly braided ponytail, just like always.
You tell Zubiri her hair looks nice?
He shrugs.
Haven't seen her. She's very busy.
We return to our starting spots. Victor is so fast. Beating him seems impossible, but there has to be a way. There is always a way. We bow. This time, I don't wait. I lunge, feinting at Victor's head before sweeping at his thighs. He doesn't buy the feint at all, doesn't even move. He blocks my clumsy strike. I start to back away, but he thrusts at my eyes. I blink before I realize I'm doing it, feel his foot behind my heel. I'm falling, but his move tells me where his leg is. I surprise myself with my speed, jam the butt of my spear into his kneecap. I feel the thonk of impact, hear him yelp in pain. I hit the ground and roll to my feet. As soon as I'm up, his spear shaft smacks into my chest, drives me backwards. I stumble, then his fist drives into my stomach so hard it lifts me off my feet. I drop my spear, land awkwardly on my hands and knees.
Victor's wooden blade touches the side of my neck.
"Point," he says.
He smiles wide, extends his hand.
"Nice shot to my knee. You're getting so much better. You..."
Bishop levels him with a flying tackle. The two boys spill into the next circle over, knocking those combatants aside. Bishop lands on top. He drives an elbow into Victor's mouth. A tooth arcs away.
"You don't touch her!"
Bishop screams, the roar of a mindless animal. He rears back for another strike. Before it lands, Bawden rushes in, drives the butt of her spear into Bishop's forehead. The thonk echoes across the plaza. Inside of me, rage explodes. I stand, step, and throw in a perfect motion. My spear closes the short distance in an instant. The wooden point bounces hard off of Bawden's sternum. She cries out, crumples to the ground. Victor staggers to his feet, blood pouring from his snarling mouth. Just as Bishop rises, Victor tackles him, driving them both into the sand again. In an instant, our discipline training session erupts into a melee. Kids grab each other, cursing, punching, and kicking. Blood and spit flies. Farrar wades into the carnage, tossing people aside like so much trash. It takes him only seconds to break up the fights. All but one. Bishop is straddling Victor, hands locked around the smaller boy's throat. Farrar grabs Bishop, throws him face first onto the sand before locking a thick arm around Bishop's neck.
"Stop fighting," Farrar growls.
My brain doesn't seem to work. What just happened to me? To all of us? Despite the weight of Farrar on his back, Ramsey's Bishop struggles to rise.
"I'll kill that little bastard."
I rush to them, grab a handful of Bishop's blonde hair, and force him to look at me.
"Bishop, stop! Victor and I had a fair fight."
He seems confused for a moment. He stops struggling. I see realization wash over his face. Farrar looks at me, questioning, as if this might be a trick.
"Let him up,"
I say. Farrar does. Bishop stands, wipes sand from his face. None of us know what to do. Victor is on his hands and knees, coughing, spitting blood. Bawden rolls from side to side, hands still covering her chest. I threw a practice spear, but I didn't think about that. If I'd held the real thing, I'd have done exactly the same. The blade would have punched through her sternum and pierced her heart. Bawden attacked my man. I instantly wanted her dead. I see someone hurrying towards us from the observatory. It's Joandra Rigby, little Kevin clutched in her arms. Even from a distance, I see she's nearly in a panic.
"Everyone," I say, "get back to the observatory now. Get Bawden and Victor to Dr. Smith."
Joandra reaches us, chest heaving.
Gaston wants you right now. He said the dragon is attacking the goblin."
Bishop and I rush into the control room. We ran here as fast as we could, neither of us discussing what just happened. He had no right to attack Victor like that. I was hit, yes, but getting hit is part of training. The way Bishop reacted, the way I reacted when Bawden tried to stop him, I'm disturbed to my core. The control room is abuzz. Gaston is up on the main platform. The smaller pedestals are all filled. He's put people to work analyzing the information we're getting from the telescope. Bariso and Schuster are there, as is Henry Bemba. Three halves delegating tasks to the collection of circles and even a few springers. Schuster is wearing black coveralls like the rest of us. No dress. We're well past the time for wearing anything but clothes suitable for war. Above the well, I see two Zolittle-shaped ships,
One is the yellow-tinged goblin, with its yellow curved thorn symbol on the circular front. The other is the green-tinged dragon. Tiny green dots are headed away from the dragon and moving towards the goblin. Bishop and I join Gaston on the platform. He glances at us, then back at the display above his pedestal.
Damn, Bishop! What happened to your head?
The spot where Bawden hit him is already swelling, a big red bump with a circle in the middle the exact diameter of a spear shaft.
Never mind that, I say. What's going on? Where's Spin?
She's sick, Gaston says. She could barely stand. Must be from the baby. She can't do anything about what's happening between these ships, so I told her to go lie down.
Spingate is always in the control room. It feels odd here without her. But considering the way she talked to me on top of the observatory, maybe it's for the best that I don't see her now.
The goblin was moving away from Omayokin, Gaston says. It wasn't leaving, just making sure it was out of Goth spear range. That brought it closer to the dragon. Dragon recently changed course and headed straight for the goblin. Now, the dragon appears to be attacking it with smaller ships.
The swarm of green dots reminds me of blurbs buzzing over the river's surface. I pull my braid around over my right shoulder and stroke it nervously.
I don't see the Zolotl, I say. Where is it?
Matilda apparently doesn't want any part of this, Gaston says. The Zolotl is behind the horizon. We can't even see it right now.
Joandra Rigby enters the control room. She's not as fast as Bishop and I, especially when lugging around a baby. She sits on the platform's edge, tries to regain her breath. On the display, I see something moving on the goblin. It's the landing bay doors, which must be huge but look tiny in relation to the massive ship, opening like the jaws of a monster.
Defensive action, Gaston says. Goblin launching fighters of her own.
A swarm of yellow dots slides out of the landing bay and heads to meet the oncoming green cloud. The yellow dots seem slower than the wave they fly out to meet. Slower and fewer. Halfway between the two great starships, the green and yellow swarms collide. Two half-solid masses become a single yellow-green cloud that sparks and flashes and flickers. It takes me a moment to realize the combined cloud is thinning. Lights of both colors are blinking out. A strand of green, maybe five dots in all, rips from the roiling cloud and heads straight at the yellow-tinged goblin.
Dragon fighters already control the combat zone, Gaston says. They're sending a few units to strafe the goblin.
I glance at Bishop. He notices my look, meets my eyes, shrugs, goes back to watching the display. He knows war, yes, but not this kind. Space is Gaston's domain. The five green dots spread out and attack the goblin from five different angles, a predator's claw clutching down at its prey. Lights flicker across the goblin's surface.
That's counterfire, Gaston says. Goblin gunners trying to shoot down the incoming dragon fighters.
One of the dragon's green specks disappears, then another. Flashes of orange blossom on the goblin. And this time it's not from counterfire. The dragon's fighters are landing big, explosive hits. Another green dot vanishes. I think that the goblin might survive this assault. Then I glance back to the roiling cloud. It is now almost completely green.
Dragon's fighters are clearly better than the goblins, Gaston says. He sounds worried.
In seconds, the last few yellow dots blink out, leaving only green. The remaining dragon fighters close in on the yellow-tinged goblin. Counterfire isn't even half of what it was to begin with. The dragon's fighters are taking out the goblin's guns.
Numerous breaches on the hull of Gamma 1, Omateotl calls out. The dragon is launching a second wave.
Six new green dots leave the dragon and head straight for the goblin. These new dots are fatter, thicker.
I think those are boarding craft, Gaston says. The dragon's crew doesn't want to destroy the goblin, they want to capture it. Omatiotl, give me more detail.
Detail is at maximum, Captain Xander.
He mumbles something under his breath, a curse word that would have gotten him severely beaten when we were in school. The fat dots reach the goblin, land on the long tapering part that sticks out the back.
The boarders will try to breach that hull, Gaston says. If they do, it will be hand-to-hand fighting against what is left of the goblin's crew.
We watch for a long time. The goblin's counterfire flickers diminish further, then cease completely. I imagine a desperate battle of knives and guns and energy blasts, a battle fought between two unknown species. More killing, and we still don't know the reason for it.
Goblin is changing course, Omatiotl calls out.
The besieged ship starts moving towards the dragon. I don't know why I pick sides, but I hope the goblin attacks. Maybe both ships will be destroyed. When it gets closer to the dragon, the goblin slows, then stops. It doesn't attack. The two motherships sit side by side, round front ends facing towards my planet.
Captured, Bishop says.
Gaston nods.
Looks that way.
Was the goblin going to attack us, like the basilisk did? If so, is it possible that the dragon took out that threat as a gesture of good faith, because those aliens want to be our allies? I wish that were true, but it seems unlikely. We don't know what this brief battle means for us. I have a feeling we won't have to wait that long to find out. Little Kevin wakes up, lets out a happy squeal. The sound is like a trigger that releases our pent-up stress. Not all of it, but enough that I relax a little. If a baby can... Wait. Something is wrong. Kevin. When Spingate isn't working, Kevin is always with her. Spingate isn't here, but I am. She would have known I'd be here for this.
Bellow.
Without another word, I sprint for the elevator. The moment I step through the door into the cell block, I hear Aramovsky shouting for help. I see him at the end of the hall, his face pressed between the bars, one arm waving madly.
Em, stop Spingate! The god of blood has her!
I slide to a halt in front of Bellow's cell, the soles of my boots skidding across the stone floor. A naked Corinne Bellow hangs from the ceiling support beam by a rope tied tight around her wrists. Her toes dangle just above the stone floor. Teresa Spingate stands in front of her. Flecks of blood dot Spingate's face. In her hand is a thin cane, the rod from the Grand Hall throne. It's smeared with thick blood, a red identical to that of the cane itself. Bellow's head hangs down, thin blonde hair half hiding a left eye that is already swollen shut. She spins slightly from left to right, the rope creaking in time. Her lower lip is split and ragged. Blood trails from the lip, from a gash on her forehead, from her horribly broken nose, down her cheeks, under her chin, and down her too white body, a path of crimson that drips from her toes into a puddle on the stone floor. Plop, plop, plop. I press my hand to the palm plate. The cell door won't open. Spingate reprogrammed it.
Teresa, open this door!
She looks at me, but I'm not sure it's me that she sees. Her eyes are wide, her teeth are bared. Her hand is a white-knuckled talon gripping the red rod. I remember Matilda using that device on me. The searing agony it caused every time she touched it to my body. Spingate is my best friend,
the person I know better than anyone. With her face twisted up like that, she is almost unrecognizable. The god of blood has her.
Bello must talk, she says. She hasn't yet, but she will.
There's cold-blooded anger in Spingate's words, but also a trembling of doubt. Maybe she thought torture would be easy.
Spin, open this god's damn cell right now!
Her voice holds doubt. Mine does not. My words are roaring muskets firing at close range. She glances at Bello.
Bello will break. She'll tell us what she knows. She has to. Why don't you understand?
My best friend is talking, but it's not really her. Teresa is a puppet, controlled by an invisible entity, by pure evil.
Something is affecting us all, I say. Something is changing us. Listen to me. We don't torture people. We're not like the grown-ups.
Spingate didn't just use the rod to shock. She beat Bello with it, severely. And still, Bello wouldn't talk. How can a woman who is so weak she cries from loneliness resist this kind of physical punishment? I realize Bello isn't spinning anymore. She isn't moving at all. The drip-drip of blood falling from her toes is slowing. Plop. Plop. I have to get in there.
Spin, if she hasn't talked yet, she's not going to. Her will is too strong. Please open the door. Please.
Spingate's face furrows in confusion.
My children, Em.
Her voice is thin, distant.
I need to protect them. Bello knows why the aliens are here. While she stays silent, our people die. Don't you see? My son could be next.
I point to Bello.
Spin, look at her.
Spingate does.
You're doing this for your children, I say. What if it works? What if torture becomes accepted in our culture, part of who we are? Imagine a world 10 years from now. Then imagine that it's Kevin hanging by his wrists, that someone is hitting him with the rod over and over and over again.
Spingate stares. She blinks. That blankness washes over her, the same one I saw on Bishop's face after he attacked Victor.
Imagine it's your son, I say. Bleeding. Screaming.
Spingate looks at the red rod in her hand like she doesn't know how it got there. A drop of blood falls from the end, splats against the cell floor. She looks at me. Horror twists her face. Horror brought on by the realization.
Em, what did I just do?
She drops the rod. It clatters against the stone. She shuffles to the cell bars, reaches through, and presses her hand to the palm plate. When she takes her hand away, it leaves smeared fingerprints of blood. The door lock clicks. I yank it open and rush inside. I draw my knife from the sheath on my thigh and slash the rope. Bello drops like a bag of meat, like she has no bones. She hits the floor. She doesn't move. I rush to her. I slice the ropes from her wrist, then sheathe my knife. I feel her face. It's cool to the touch. I press my ear to her chest. No heartbeat. I lay her flat on her back, put my hands on her sternum and drive them down once, twice, three times, just like Smith showed us to do. I press my mouth to Bello's and breathe out hard. She doesn't respond. I do chest compressions again, again push air into her lungs. She doesn't respond.
Over and over I do this, feeling the rage building inside me, sensing my soul eroding, flaking away. How could my best friend beat a woman to death? Hands on my shoulders. A man's hands.
Let me try, Aramofsky says.
Spingate let him out. I fall to my butt and get out of his way. Aramofsky's chest compressions are stronger. His larger lungs force in more air than mine ever could. He is methodical, pumping away, desperate to save Bello. Still, she doesn't respond. A sheen of sweat breaks out on Aramofsky's dark skin. Of course it does. It's so hot in this cell, and he's working so hard. She's not moving. I start to crawl backwards, wanting to get away from the body. My hand comes down on something round. The rod.
Come on, Aramofsky hisses as he keeps pumping. Come on, Bello, fight!
I hear crying, and for a moment my heart surges with hope, because that's what Bello does, cry. Until I realize it's not her, it's Spingate. She's standing in the open cell doorway. Tears streak her blood-flecked face. Her lower lip quivers. Really? Now she feels bad? I pick up the rod. Aramofsky sits back, wipes sweat from his forehead with the back of his hand.
It's no use, he says. Bello is dead.
I feel myself nodding as I stand.
Of course she is, I say, because this god's damned gear killed her.
I step towards Spingate. She stares at me, shakes her head.
I didn't mean...
Yes, you did, you bitch, I say, then I jam the rod tip into her neck.
Spingate's body convulses. She makes a strange gurgling sound.
Yes, you did, I say, and I pull the rod away.
She collapses backwards into the space between the row of cells, her arms wrapped protectively around her round belly.
Yes, you did.
I step out of the cell, touch the rod to her cheek. She convulses anew, that strange sound coming from deep in her throat. Her face wrinkles tight in agony. Her splayed fingers stretch out, half curled, grabbing at nothing. I am going to kill this bitch. Her and her unborn baby, which will probably turn out just as evil as she is.
Spingate torture circles? She murders my kind? I'll show her.
I press the rod harder against her face, using it to pin her head against the stone floor. A blur of motion. The rod is ripped from my grasp. I turn to face Aramofsky. Sheened in sweat, he holds the rod in his right hand.
The god of blood has you, he says. Fight it.
I draw my knife. The images on the observatory walls of double rings torturing people, burning them, skinning them. Aramofsky, who started a war, who sent me out to die. He should have killed me when he had the chance.
Fight it, Em, he says, snarling out the words. You are the strongest of us. Don't let it control you.
I drop into a fighting stance, looking for a way past the rod he holds. Aramofsky tosses the rod into the cell. He puts his hands to his sides. He closes his eyes.
Kill me if you must, he says. But if you do, the god of blood will own you forever.
I see the veins in his neck pulsing beneath his skin. One slash of my blade will open up those veins.
Aramofsky's blood will spray everywhere, just like the pigs did. It will flow and puddle, just like Yong's did. The god of blood has you. I blink. I hear nothing. All I see is a defenseless man standing before me. My knife clatters against the stone floor. I glance at Spingate. She's curled up on the floor, shaking, drooling blood. I glance at Bello, naked, lifeless, dead. Aramofsky opens his eyes.
Now you know, Em, he says. Now you know what it's like.
That was Alone episode number 10. You guys, Spingate has lost it. And Em almost lost it. The God of Blood. Is it real? What is happening to these kids? How do I reach these kids? Before the episode, I told you I would tell you about some LA developments, some Hollywood developments. And it's the usual thing. I can't really talk about it. Trust me, there's nothing official. There's no pending series or pilot or anything like that. But I do like to keep you informed. This is fascinating. All of the work that A Real Girl and I have done over the past 5 or 6 years to try and get into Hollywood with our own properties, the closest we might come outside of Nocturnal is a random encounter. I met a director in line at a sushi restaurant at Dragon Con 2015 in Atlanta, Georgia. And it turned out he had read Infected and really liked it. And we just sat down, we started talking, and I had seen some of his music videos, but then went back and watched the movies he had directed, and we really hit it off. And he had this property he was trying to adapt from an old show, and he couldn't get clearance for it. So he had this whole reboot milieu set up, and then, okay, well, can't do anything with it. So he kind of gave it to me. He said, here's the strategy I'm going for. I want to do this theme. I kind of want to approach this theme of how young American men in the changing landscape often aren't sure of how to behave, and they don't know how to react in certain environments, and they have a different socio-political environment than we had back in the, you know, we were kids in the 80s. And he gave it to me, so I want to preserve this theme, but the world is no longer applicable, and this hero is no longer applicable, so can you reskin it, basically come up with this whole new thing. And I did that, and we had our first LA meeting pitch on it, and the network really liked it and wanted us to come back and do another one. So now another pitch for the same property. So now we are going back in, and this is interesting because Nocturnal had a great producer attached to it, still does, Lloyd Levin, who did Hellboy, Hellboy 2, The Green Zone, Boogie Nights. So we're still trying to get Nocturnal made. But this new one has a producer attached to it who we're working with and the director himself, who right now is a really hot property and kind of hitting it on all cylinders. So when we go in to pitch this one, it'll have a, you know, New York Times bestselling author, a Grammy Award winning video director and movie director, and a producer who's made a couple of my favorite movies. So we'll see how that goes. But it's fascinating that all of this has come from, hey, who is this person standing next to me in line at the sushi restaurant in Atlanta, Georgia, during the schmoz that is Dragon Con. So this movie or this TV show is not my original content, or at least it wasn't. Now it sort of is, but it's not a book you guys would know. This is all new stuff. We'll see how it goes. I'll keep you informed. Next meeting is in January, first week of January. As for the music, I told you I'm playing in a couple bands. I don't know if I've mentioned this in a podcast before or not, but I'm playing bass for Evan Diamond and The Library. That's right. I'm a member of The Library. Quite fitting for an author. Evan Diamond is a young chanteuse out of San Diego area with just a killer voice, killer work ethic, becoming a really good songwriter. And we back her up and play a bunch of shows. And I just played a show last night. So it was very fun. Of course, the other one that you may have talked about before, you've seen in my social media, is Tennessee Tina and the Last Chance Saloon. Been some lineup changes in that band. That always happens in the world of music. But lots of shows coming up for both acts. I hope to get some pictures and video up for all of you to enjoy. If you're not following me on Facebook, do it. Facebook.com/ScottSigler. Twitter, of course, is Twitter.com/ScottSigler. Instagram, Instagram.com/ScottSigler. Follow me there. We'll have pictures and video and all kinds of fun stuff up. Evan will have an EP out shortly. 6 songs, I believe. I played on all of those songs. I will let everybody know when that is available. And Tina is also getting ready to go in the studio when she gets her lineup reformatted. I will tell you this. I like both bands. I'm just enjoying making music. When I do it, I don't think about the books or the business or anything else. So just like my fiction is a great escape for a lot of you guys from your daily life, I take you away. Music is the escape from mine. Really lets my brain reboot. And I focus just on the notes and the rhythm. And the next thing I know, I've been playing for an hour or 2 hours. And I come back to the daily work life. And everything seems refreshed and renewed. And I can get back to work. So just thought I'd share. Because I'm a sharing, caring kind of cat. I'm a share bear. Like a care bear, but they overshare things. That's it for this week, you guys. I don't know if you heard our 20th anniversary edition of Good Will Hunting for Story Smack, but you can find that at facebook.com/StorySmack or at scottsigler.com. Just scroll down and you will see it. A Real Girl and I talk about this wonderful, wonderful movie, which won Robin Williams an Academy Award, launched the careers of Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. Minnie Driver puts in a stellar performance. It's top to bottom, a super fun flick. It's 20 years gone. So go check that out. Listen to our take on that. We had a lot of fun doing it. That is it for this week. I will be back next week with Alone, episode number 11. And until then, I will talk to you all real soon.
You have been listening to Alone, book 3 in the Generations trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. Produced by Scott Sigler and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram, where his handle is at Scott Sigler, ScottSigler, one word, or join our Facebook group at facebook.com/ScottSigler. Theme music is the song Unseen Horrors by Kevin MacLeod.